Welcome to Bridge Ed, the education podcast brought to you by The Bridge at Wellington College. I'm Ian Henderson, and I'm excited to be joined by a host of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in our sector. In this episode, we'll be talking to Lalith Vijayadoru, who has an extraordinary life and work that we'd love to hear more about. I first met Lalith at an exciting event to do with Empathy, run by Ed Kerwin of Empathy Studios back in London just a couple of months ago. We really connected, I think, over that and felt there was something that could be really valuable here. So welcome, Lalith, and also welcome to my wonderful colleague, Karen Taylor, who's Head of Education Research here at The Bridge. Lalith, welcome.
Thank you.
I wonder whether we could just start by, tell us a little bit about your journey to this point.
Well, so I'm glad that we met at an event all about empathy, because empathy is it's all about understanding somebody else's perspective.
Yeah.
And I think my whole journey has been about making sure I understand other people. Mm. But probably what's fueled that is probably because not many people understood me. Mm. And I think my initial journey starts over that. Actually, I came from quite an adverse childhood experience background. On the surface of it, I'm the third child of two university educated middle class parents who are economic migrants from Sri Lanka. Mm. And I was born and raised in Hong Kong. And so we are a middle class family. But the adversity that I faced is that I had a parent who had quite significant mental health issues. Mm. And there was quite significant physical and emotional abuse that we endured as children at home. Mm. And I think for me, as a child growing up, it's not having your voice heard. Mm. It's almost being invisible. And the reason why I became a pediatrician was because I felt very strongly to advocate for children,
yeah,
given my own adverse experiences. Yeah. And so I come from a background where I think it's important for us to be able to express ourselves, yeah, in safe, reflective spaces,
yeah,
and often express ourselves when we want to talk about quite uncomfortable truths.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a really strong school of thought that the root cause of most conflicts becoming disputes and sometimes more toxic than that is rooted in not being heard. Interesting to hear that. So what's it led you to now?
So I worked in, I trained as a doctor and I was committed to training in pediatrics, so working for children. I came from an international background, so yeah, I was born in Hong Kong to Sri Lankan parents and I was educated, I finished school in Beijing. And so I've always had this multicultural global perspective. Mm. And the work that I wanted to do as a doctor was very much related to, yeah, international child health.
Yeah.
And so I did a master's degree in global child health and worked for the University of Oxford and Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine,
yeah,
doing research and teaching and education around children with fever in resource limited settings. Okay. Given my cultural heritage,
yeah,
of Asia, I was very much focused on
yeah,
Asia.
Yeah.
But then in terms of the clinical perspective, I was very much focused in emergency care settings. So
right,
I trained as a pediatrician who specialized in working in emergency departments. So that includes minor illness, minor injury, yeah, as well as major illness and major injury. So, and of course, given my own childhood background, mm, always advocating for the safeguarding of children,
yeah,
in that context. And so my UK interests are about the recognition and response to child abuse in emergency care settings.
Yeah.
My global hat is about the correct diagnosis and treatment and management,
mm,
of children with fever in,
yeah,
in resource-limited settings, particularly in Asia.
Yeah.
And so... So what I do now is actually I'm very concerned about the emotional well-being of the workforce.
Mm.
And of course, given working in the healthcare sector,
yeah,
where you will work under very high pressure,
yeah,
you will work dealing with very emotionally charged situations.
Mm.
You may work in systems which perhaps are challenging or do not work.
Yeah.
And so the social and emotional impact of working in healthcare involving children,
mm,
is significant.
Yeah.
And so I felt very strongly, given my own experiences of struggling with some of the ethical and emotional challenges in my own profession, to work in spaces where healthcare staff could share,
mm,
stories about the social and emotional impact of their work in safe, reflective spaces.
Yeah.
And so it was doing that during my, on top of my busy clinical,
yeah,
workload, where I recognized the impact that this was having on staff engagement, on staff morale, on staff mental health, all so many positive benefits that I thought, maybe I need to take this to the wider workforce, not just healthcare. And it's interesting that I'm here talking to education, because the first lot of professionals that I wanted to extend this to were teachers. Because like hospitals and healthcare, you know, the schools and hospitals are some of the most complex organizations in the world, you know, and in terms of the professionals who are advocating and very much supporting children actually are perhaps not very good at looking after themselves. And so working in the sector of child abuse, I worked with social care, law, health, as well as education.
Interesting.
So I was very interested in looking at those professionals who looked at challenging situations supporting children to see how I could support their emotional well.
Yeah, fascinating. And it's really resonant at this time with, you know, quite significant retention issues within the teaching sector. Admittedly, there's good work being done in lots of areas to try and redress some of that. But this, it sounds like this could be really impactful in that area. And also one thing that you just talked about there, and one reason why I wanted Karen to join us today was Karen's interest and expertise in multilingual and intercultural education, and which I think gives us a really good link.
I think there's something else that comes to mind as well. And yes, I mean, I do have that deep interest in intercultural learning. But as you're speaking, I'm thinking about some of the research that talks about the fact that teachers, like people in the medical profession, engage in emotional labor. And yet we don't think a lot about how much what we feel has an impact on our attention, the decisions that we make, the way we think about things, and sort of bringing that to the surface. And allowing people to be honest in that safe, reflective space about what is deeply inside of them, I think might allow people to deliberate in different ways about their actions, how they want to be or how they need to be, if that makes sense.
I think what you said is right on the money. And I just want to kind of extend that to say there are benefits to the individual in doing that. In reflecting on your story or perhaps a challenging situation or even a joyful situation, whatever the situation, if you reflect on it in a story-like way and present it, you process it yourself. You kind of like, you ruminate over it and you kind of frame it in a certain way. But there is also a power in the people listening. So if you have a sympathetic audience, in particular, people who are doing similar jobs to you or aligned to the jobs that you do, there is a connection. Because people can resonate with, I have had a very similar experience to that, or I've had a very different experience to that.
Yeah.
And understanding people's lived experience through true personal narratives have benefits to both the storyteller as well as the people who listen. Yeah. And when you talked about the emotional labor, we always talk about a problem shared is a problem halved.
Yeah.
Many of my storytelling clients feel that I have been struggling with this alone. And when they share it and receive resonances from people who've had similar experiences and who have the confidence to say that out loud, suddenly you don't feel alone. And that's what can, and that creates connection and therefore perhaps allows you to process or progress in a different way.
And I was thinking about something you said when we were talking at lunch, and that sometimes the act of telling the story to an empathetic listener, so being heard, can also bring clarity in ways about oneself that perhaps it's very difficult to do on one's own.
That's so true. I mean, one of my roles as a facilitator is that I help people craft stories. So it's not like, here's a microphone, off you go.
Yeah.
It is, and it's a well thought out crafted story, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end, maybe with a moral or a message through it, maybe influenced by a theme. And as you say, actually that process of crafting it can provide clarity. But when you actually say it out loud, when you receive that resonance, it's not only clarity, there's almost a validation that when I help people craft their stories, they say, I've never seen my story in that way before.
Yeah.
Because all I'm doing is holding up a mirror in an objective way. And they say, oh, actually, I've been telling myself a very different narrative.
Yeah.
And so there is a clarity when you reflect that, but also when you share it, somebody else can validate that actually the different narrative, maybe the right one, maybe.
And it sounds like there's something really powerful here about enabling the listener to experience somebody else's world, whatever's happening, in a way that exhibits true empathy. In other words, that they can honor and accept where that person is without distortion, narrative, or judgment. They're not imposing their own story on it. There's no twisting of that person's story in order to fit, you know, oh, the same thing happened to me, which is often, I think, a bit of a barrier for some people.
I agree. And I think it's very, very important that this is about people's true lived experience. Yeah. And as part of setting the space where these stories are shared, part of the ground rules should be, you may hear things that you disagree with.
Yeah.
You may hear things which will make you very uncomfortable because it's very different from your own lived experience. Yeah. Please respect the storyteller.
Yeah.
That this is their lived experience.
Yeah.
And as you say, part of the resonance and the response to it can be very different. I mean, I can give a slightly uncomfortable example where during Black Lives Matter in the health service, a Trinidadian nurse shared a very powerful story about her experience of being passed over for promotion, very clearly on a racial basis. And a person from a different ethnic, from the ethnic majority in the audience, listening to that, responded, "That couldn't have happened. Not in this hospital. I don't believe this happened." And so again, there is that, as you alluded to, maybe sometimes sense of denial that actually somebody else's lived experience may be very different from yours.
Yeah.
But I think if done in a sensitive and respectful way, people's eyes can be opened.
Yeah.
And if we think about, in terms of broadcasting, the Rivian principles like the BBC operates on, it's that stories should be there to inform, should be there to educate, as well as entertain.
Yeah.
And of course, all of those things means changing perspective. We need to change audiences' perspectives.
And in an authentic and genuine way, which is one of the things I like so much about your work. So just moving on to stories themselves, and we've begun to touch on why stories are so powerful, because they can inform and educate and entertain and connect people with somebody's perspective and their reality, their lived reality in the moment. So I'm just curious if you could go on a little bit more. So what makes a story so powerful compared to another way of getting over somebody's story?
I mean, I don't think, I mean, you're educators, you know, our children learn through stories.
Mm.
You know, if we think about religious texts, we think about parables, we think about folklore, we explain or make sense of the world that we live in through stories.
Mm.
And I think one of the key powers of story is that they are remarkably economical in conveying very complex messages, but in a very digestible way. And, you know, if you just say a simple narrative, actually you can peel away so many layers from a simple story.
Yeah.
So I think bite-sized digestible chunks of stories can be really economical in terms of complexity.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of their key powers. The other thing is that through stories, particularly about stories of the true personal narrative, is that stories are a sensory experience.
Yeah.
When what draws people into a story, it's what did it look like?
Yeah.
What did it smell like? What did it sound like?
Yeah.
And that sensory description, again, going back to childhood, it's how we make sense of the world.
Yeah.
And so if through story you can bring out those sensory experiences, it brings things really to life.
Mm.
So I think it makes it more engaging.
Yeah.
And then the third element, I think, that is the most powerful, is about the use of emotion.
Yeah.
What connects us to other people's stories are the human emotions.
Yeah.
I think very much about us as humans, and I'm very interested in us as, you know, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens.
Mm.
And why are we Homo sapiens? Sapien relating to wisdom is our use of abstract thought and complex language.
And
so if we can use those language, words, languages, and image to convey complexity of emotion, that is what connects us as humans.
Yeah.
And so use emotions to connect.
Yeah.
And so that's what I feel.
Fabulous. So one of the, I think, probably the most important area of work that Bridge is focusing on, along with many other key organizations and leaders in this country, is in an era when we've got AI this and AI that and technology the other, education itself is an inherently human endeavor. It's a relational endeavor. So what we're really trying to work on is this idea of clarifying and energizing and igniting this move for education to become about education to be human, educating for character, educating for flourishing, so that young people can go off into the world in whatever way as they grow up and have a moral compass to navigate as yet unknown decisions that they have to, because we can't know, but to understand who they are and what they stand for and so on and so on. And I'm curious about that particular part of storytelling to enable people to really connect to what matters to them and what makes them who they are as a human.
That's, I'm so glad you said that. There's a really nice quote from a professor at the London School of Economics. I can't remember his name. Mm. But it's a really good quote. It said, as machines in the world of AI, as machines get better at becoming machines, humans need to be better at being human. Mm. And so again, when I go back to what makes us human, abstract thoughts, language, emotion.
Yeah.
So a lot of the work that I do with organizations relate to identity.
Yeah.
And so I'm a graduate of the International Baccalaureate, and I was very grateful that actually the IB really grounded me in what my sense of identity was and all those different aspects of my identity. At the time when I was at school, it was very much about my ethnicity, nationality, residency. That kind of cultural identity was something very, very strong. The areas of gender and sexuality and neurodiversity, that kind of came up more in my mid to late 20s.
Right.
But at school, cultural identity was very, very strong. So I think it's very important to use story to celebrate the different aspects of our identity. And not only is this good for oneself in terms of understanding who one is, it's also good for understanding others.
Yeah.
And so particularly when we talk about minority groups and amplifying minority voices, I find stories a very good way of amplifying minority voice. But also I think it's important from an intersectionality point of view that actually if you look at different minorities, that there are so many common threads that minority groups face, and using stories to find those connections can be extremely powerful.
Yeah.
So again, use of emotions to connect, but also understanding the lived experience and finding the similarities as well as our differences.
Yeah. And as you were talking, sorry, Karen, you were
saying no, something.
As you were talking throughout this, that we've mentioned emotion, and I think using emotion not just as a thing on it, we respect the emotion as it is, but also it's what's the emotion telling us.
Mm.
And emotions tell us a lot about our values, about what matters to us. And in terms of creating that identity, that self-knowledge, that self-regulation, self-actualization, I think that's a really key issue. And I'm wondering whether that's something that specifically comes out through the process of creating a story, or whether it's a sort of nice byproduct or neither.
Oh, all of the above.
Yeah.
So as you were talking, I was thinking about, if you think about a narrative is a series of events. So if you're crafting your story, you are the central character in this narrative.
Yeah.
And this character will go through a series of events showing what they are and what their values are.
Yeah.
And maybe things will happen to this character that maybe support or compromise their personal values.
Yeah.
And as you say, the emotion to that compromise, injury, insult, or whatever it is, or proclamation, support, celebration, the emotion will tell you what that value means.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yes, absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely.
You could use that.
You're making me think of some work by Bill Powell and Kasuma Ochenpal, where they speak about the role of the teacher as being an emotional intelligence coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how important it is to be able to, or to help students, or perhaps oneself, to name an emotion, to acknowledge it. So I think that's, there's some the echoing of this idea of the need to be seen and heard.
Yeah.
But then what you do with that emotion may or may not be okay.
Yeah.
And so the role of the teacher is somehow to help the student ponder that.
Yeah.
And come to some kind of conclusion that allows for them to feel what they feel naturally, but to integrate that into a collective.
As you were saying this, I'm not sure. I'm an 80s child, and there's a film, Pretty Woman, which actually was released on my birthday the 1990s. But there is a scene when Richard Gere's character and Julia Roberts are in the bath together, and he's talking about his traumatic childhood with his relationship with his father. And he said, I've been to a therapist, and I am angry with my father. I am angry with my father. He goes, that cost me thousands of dollars of therapy just to say that. But I think, what jokes aside, what he's acknowledging that he had an emotion, because clearly in his childhood that emotion was repressed, and it's only now in later life that he's able to acknowledge. So I think when you talked about the emotion intelligence coach, the first step is to name it and acknowledge it.
Without judgment. I'm placing it here, I place my story here.
Yes.
When I'm talking with you.
Yeah. My heart is on the table here. Yeah. This is my emotion. This is what happened, and this is how I feel.
Yeah.
Acknowledge.
Yeah.
And leave it at that.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be fixed. It doesn't need to be healed. It doesn't need to be. Just the process of acknowledging it, I think, is a huge step.
Yeah. And I'm just building on that. It's interesting. So, as a coach, one of the things that we might do is to notice an emotion, acknowledge it and accept it, and it's there. It is genuinely what people are experiencing in that moment. But possibly building on it by asking, well, what's that emotion telling you?
Mm.
So again, there's no judgment in there. It's not that emotion is right or wrong or good or bad or ugly or whatever. It's just what's it telling you? Because the emotion itself needs acknowledging, and there's also value in that emotion.
I listened to a very interesting podcast about the meaning of life. Big one talks about happiness. And they talked about four pillars of meaning.
Yeah.
One is belonging.
Yeah.
Second is purpose. The third is transcendence. And the fourth is storytelling. And I want to relate transcendence and storytelling from a physiological point of view. When I was working in the emergency department, for staff well-being, I applied for a grant called Perform at Your Peak. And we used elite athlete heart monitoring. These elite athletes used to look at heart rate variability and to check what was happening to our emergency department staff during the day at our work, to see where their levels of stress and things were. So I, of course, was working on busy shifts and also doing storytelling to support staff well-being. The only time when my heart was in the green healthy zone in my working day was when I was facilitating storytelling.
Yeah.
And so again, that was another impetus to say, maybe this is good for my health.
Yeah.
But the reason why it was because storytelling provides us an opportunity to escape, to pause, reflect, and transcend the grind of our daily lives into somebody else's world and transport us away. So it transcends that. And it's that period of being away, suspending ourselves away from our reality, that gives us that time to process and reflect. And actually does wonders for our physiological health, and then allows us to return back to that thing and process things differently. And the other example I have is the reason why I love film, and I'm from South Asia. As you know, India has got one of the biggest film industries in the world. And you know, the people who are in the lower middle class will save for the whole month to go to the cinema. And why is Bollywood and their films so theatrical and song and dance and beautiful people and amazing colors? Because it transports people away from their mundane lives that they can transcend, make sense of their own lives, and then return to their reality. Yeah. And that is physiologically good.
And I can imagine a similar experiment happening in staff rooms around the country with teachers, with those elite heart monitors, and just seeing, you know, when are they in the green zone? Coming back to stories themselves, you've mentioned a little bit about the narrative and the fact that for a person's story, they are the central character in their narrative. So what other features are present in really great stories?
So many people, I mean, the art of storytelling, it's an art. There may not be a formula, but if we think about where stories are shared, soap operas and TV and film and cinema, and of course in the written word, generally a very common formula is that you need to have characters.
Yeah.
You need to have the central character, and there may be some secondary characters. Yeah. And in terms of these characters, we need to really understand them. We need to say, we need to know what they look like. We need to know what's important to them, how they make you feel, and the things that they say, so we can kind of connect with them. But there also needs to be a series of events. That's why I talk about the narrative. So we've got this character that goes on some sort of journey, which illustrates who they are or not.
Yeah.
But an important ingredient in an engaging story is this kind of crisis, a climax, that this character that we know, who is, we know their context, we know their background, faces a crisis.
Yeah.
And in that crisis, they have to somehow adapt to this crisis and emerge from this crisis changed in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily for the better, but for the worse. But there is an adaptation. And with that adaptation, there is a resolution. And so that is called that storytelling arc.
Yes.
And so I think that's kind of generally what needs to happen.
Yeah.
But all, as I say, the thing that needs to, that connects the listener or the viewer are the emotions. Mm. How do we connect with this character?
Yeah.
Can we imagine, are we taken into their world and understand the impact of those series of events on that character?
Yeah.
And that's what a good story is, if we can produce that emotional connection.
Yeah, lovely. So when you go and work with people, whether it's individuals or groups, tell us a little bit more about how you go about helping them craft the story.
So I find it very useful for people to craft stories around a theme.
Yeah.
So for example, if I'm working for Women's History, so at the moment, what am I doing? Women's History Month happens.
Yeah.
We take the theme for International Women's Day, which in this time was accelerate action.
Yeah.
And so I like to just take words. I like words. So we just take the word accelerate. And, we talked about moving forward. And so using that as an inspiration and just kind of word playing it with somebody and saying, you know, what does this word mean to you and things. And then from there, stories start to emerge.
Yeah.
And then thinking about, and so what I do is then help them develop, look at them as a character and find a story where they have to interact with other characters.
Yeah.
But I like using a theme as inspiration and wordplay association to kind of kickstart some thought about stories.
Yeah.
But also what I do is when people share a story and they share their kind of like approach to a story, I act as an independent audience member and say, well, why did you do that? Or why didn't you do this? And what were the factors that made in that decision? And again, that will get their, again, thinking to think, well, I've been telling myself this story in this way. Maybe if I'd done it that way. That's also part of the joy of being able to reflect back somebody's experience.
Yeah.
It makes me think about how you must have very advanced questioning skills.
So as a pediatrician who worked in child abuse, you've got to have what's called professional curiosity.
Yeah.
So I think in crafting stories, you have to be curious about this person. So I'm unashamedly provocative and probing.
But
does that link with the way you think about coaching?
So I think there's some definite crossovers there. So having a deep curiosity about the person being willing to listen and properly listen. You're listening not just to what's being said, but what's not being said and to how they are when they say things, how they are when they don't say things. That's all listening as far as I'm concerned. Listening is not just to the spoken word. I think the ability to craft questions where you know what you want the impact of the question to be. I want this to open up something. I don't know what it's going to open up. I want it to open up something for that person or whatever. The craft of questioning is much misunderstood. I think an awful lot of people who think they're really good at asking questions are maybe not quite as good as they think they are, because I think society in general tends to maybe overestimate its kind of questioning, its grasp of the questioning craft. We're very good at asking leading questions. We're very good at asking questions where the answer is somewhere embedded in the question, even if only subtly and implicitly. And sometimes people are really good at asking questions that are grammatically open, but not remotely open in spirit, because what they are is just guess what's in my mind.
Yeah.
Guess what's in the teacher's mind is a classic, you know, kind of questioning, failing, if you like, in the classroom. So I think there are things. I think the big difference is that in coaching, you're not actually particularly remotely interested in the story as a narrative. What you're interested in, And what you're curious about is, I'm curious for growth. I'm curious for discovery. I'm curious for movement. That's where my curiosity is focused. Whereas when your job is to create and help them create their story and to refine that story and then tell that story in a really accurate, authentic and compelling way, you are definitely curious about them and about their story. So I think that's where there's a difference, but there are many sort of crossover skills, I suspect.
It's interesting because some of my corporate clients, when I, you know, in their working day, you know, I have an hour with them to help craft their story. Yeah. And, you know, it's not uncommon where I get emails back or from their managers to say, they felt it was like therapy.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of their day, somebody's asking questions about them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, all the time they're defending themselves or attacking or trying to pitch sales, depending on the sector. Mm. But, you know, to have somebody really listen to you in the middle of your working day is almost like this anomaly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
but it just makes me feel so sad to think about, you know, what is it about our world or many parts of our world that people, in fact, feel quite isolated?
Mm. Yeah.
And how to change that.
Yeah.
And if I could just one more question, because there's a word that keeps coming into my mind as you're both speaking, and that is where does intuition come in?
Mm.
Because, and in part because we have someone working with us through Sandcastle who's doing some research on you know, intuition in teaching practice. And I feel like, you know, you're coaching or you're helping someone reveal their story. Or illuminate, you're illuminating their story. And, you know, where are the moments where there's something intuitive about the question you ask or the opening that you seek for them? And I wonder if you could talk about that.
I go back to what you said about what is not being said.
Yeah.
I think that's where my intuition lies. Because you could, if I had to write, so if I'm interviewing somebody and they're saying these things, I write it on the left side. As you say, on the right side, what's not being said?
Mm.
And I think that's that's my intuition.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. And you kind of test out that intuition by asking actually carefully crafted, non-threatening, non-judgmental questions. Or you can just offer something up as a reflection and just see how it lands. And if that reflection resonates in some way, then you kind of know your intuition was somewhere in the right area. And if that reflection doesn't resonate at all, then that's fine. And I can offer an intuition with zero attachment. It doesn't have to. I don't have to be right about this. It's just a useful way of testing it out. So
I'm also grateful that from 20 years of working as a doctor, you can see patterns in the way people describe things.
Mm.
You can also see common patterns of human behavior given their context. And it's the professional curiosity for me is about joining the dots.
Yeah.
Mm.
And, you know, if you think about this particular person in this particular context experienced this particular sense of events, it's likely that they would feel or respond this way, given that I have seen this pattern recognition many times before. So again, that may be the other kind of part of intuition, saying if I could just, it's almost predictive modeling that you are just saying, if you combine this, 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 and this, you are likely to get this. And this, I think, when we talk about AI, that's what AI is very good at doing, is that if we use our human ways of recognizing patterns, machines can also do this.
Yeah.
So, sidetrack.
Mm.
Oh, they can do that sort of analysis, but they can't do the connection part.
Yeah. It's one of the great questions when people talk about, you know, is it likely that we're going to have AI-based coaches that are really effective? And I think you can train an AI coach in a coaching model, in a way of asking questions. They can be literate in terms of structure of questions, and they can listen to what's said. Can they listen to what's not being said? Partly. They can register emotion and so on and so on. Do they have intuition yet? And at what point does that become something that's either the missing link or the thing that
I'm fascinated in the detection of emotion, that the use of AI. So I'm here sharing a story and blah, 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 and the AI can detect or
but not feel. So
that's where
there's a bit of a danger, because when we anthropomorphize the AI tool, we are imagining that there is empathy.
Yeah.
When there is only recognition.
Yeah.
Which
And I'm sure you can already train AI tools in some form to recognize emotion from expression and so on. But what about someone who uses Botox? how do they get that? I don't know whether AI is able to do that yet or whether it will be. But that's an interesting aside. As we begin to draw to a close, I wonder whether there's any sort of lasting thing you'd like to leave us with.
Because this is an education, this is a podcast about education, I just want to do a big shout out to recognizing the huge social and emotional impact that those working with children have to face.
Yeah.
And some of my biggest and most, when I say successful, as the most impactful interventions have been in education with teachers both in the state and the independent sector. And so I just want to, this is a promotion to say, don't underestimate the importance of being able to share stories in safe, reflective spaces with your colleagues. And as somebody who has worked with children from a healthcare perspective, particularly in child abuse and working with law, health, social care, as well as education, I have great admiration and respect. Yeah. And I would like to end with my story about, as I mentioned, I was somebody who's suffered with physical and emotional abuse at school. And I loved school because it was my sanctuary. It was the place that I went to where I received love and attention I didn't own. And so I have a big admiration for my teachers, who were the ones who recognized the abnormalities in my behavior and my performance. And actually raised the flag.
Yeah.
Even though that flag came to my parents, and my parents managed to pull the wool over their eyes about it, the teachers recognized it.
Yeah.
And so now, doing what I do, I think long and hard about what impact did my case have on those teachers who recognized.
Yeah.
They were curious.
Yeah.
They cared.
Yeah.
They were concerned. But what impact did it have on them?
Yeah.
And so part of the whys of my business, in particular in supporting teachers, is I know what they must have gone through when looking out for vulnerable children like me.
Yeah. Well, what a lovely way to demonstrate the essential importance and the role that teachers play in the development of young people and their sense of identity. And their sense of feeling that they belong in the world. So, Lalith, thank you very much indeed. It's been wonderful to have a further talk following our initial meeting, and we look forward to collaborating more in the future.
Thank you very much.
I'm left thinking even more deeply about the contribution of storytelling to people's identity, to their sense of belonging, and specifically to what it means to be human and to live a flourishing life, both of which are, I think, some of the hottest topics in education for the next few years. I'm curious what you took away from that fascinating conversation. Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.